my eyes, and yet they weren't my eyes. They were his own. That was my mouth, all right, sensuous and a little large for the face, but it had nothing of the cruelty of my mouth. Just a beautiful young boy, in spite of looking like me, a beautiful young man. The face vanished, and I saw a flash of images now of this young man, perhaps as Severin had once seen him, striding along an American street, dressed in regular clothes, jeans, a sweater, sneakers, a healthy, glowing young man. Pain. Unspeakable pain. It didn't matter who in this world or any other was staring at me, watching me, seeking to share this moment, or merely shuddering as I experienced it. It just didn't matter, because in pain like this one is always alone. "I have another shock for you," said Severin. I didn't reply. "There is a young woman with Victor whom you also love," said Severin. "Her name is Rose."
"Rose?"
I whispered.
"Not my Rose."
This pain was rolling suddenly towards fury.
"How in God's name did they get their hands on my Rose?"
"Let me tell you," said Severin. "Let me explain." Then slowly, in a low voice, she told me what had befallen Rose. She told me how my attorneys were trying to reach me, but then I'd been ignoring all worldly messages of late, and she recounted the details of an assault on Rose, her blindness, the scarring of her face and throat, and how she had cried out for me over and over in her agony, and how Seth had heard that cry, how Farid had heard it, and how, on my behalf, they had intervened. "Oh, Death, you are so determined to have my beloved Rose. Death, you cannot stop seeking to take my precious Rose." "The girl was given just enough of the blood to cure her blindness," said Severin, "but never enough to take root in her. Just enough of the blood to heal her esophagus, heal her skin, but never enough to begin the transformation. She's still fully human, and she loves your son, and he loves her." I think I murmured something like, "This is all Farid's doing," but my heart wasn't in it. I didn't care. I absolutely didn't care. The rage was gone. Only the pain remained. I kept seeing the image of the boy, and I needed no one to give me an image of my beloved Rose. My sweet, brave Rose, who'd been so happy when I last saw her. My tender, loving Rose, whom I'd given up for her sake, knowing that she was now too old to be near me any more, too old to be confused by what I was. My Rose and Victor.
"These things are now commonly known," said Severin, "because this boy and this girl have been brought by Farid and Seth to join the others. And you must go there too. Leave Maharit to her own resources. The meeting is what matters. Whatever happens to Maharit, the voice will still be the challenge, and tomorrow at sunrise we must go."
I sat still staring at the surface of the table, thinking of what all this might mean. A long moment passed, and then Eleni said tenderly,
"Please do come with us to join the others. It's past time for us to be there."
I glanced at her eager face and that of Eugenie beside her. And my eyes passed over the strangely expressive faces of Raymond Galland and then Grant. How infinitely more human they seemed than the rest of us.
"Listen to me," said Gabrielle impatiently. "You can't conceivably respond to all these revelations now. No one can. But be assured that this girl, Rose, is on the verge of madness, as always happens with those who know too much of us. Victor, on the other hand, has always known you were his father. And he grew up with his mother's love, and knows what she is, too. So let's be on our way tomorrow night to resolve this, if nothing else, and then the matter of the voice."
I nodded, trying not to show a bitter smile. What a hand they had played! Had it been deliberate, calculating? Didn't much matter in the scheme of things. It was what it was.
"You think these matters are more important than the voice?" I asked.
You think these matters cannot wait a little longer?
I don't know what I think. I can't think. My mind's not made up.
I think if you return to Maharet, said Gabriel, you'll be very disappointed at what you find out, and she may very well destroy you.
Tell me what you know now, I said. I was suddenly furious. Tell me now!
What matters is what all of us know when we gather, said Gabriel. She was as angry as I was. Not what I suspect, or what fragmentary images I've caught or someone else has caught. Don't you understand? We're facing a worse crisis than we did last time. Can't you see that? But we have Severin, and this ancient one Seth, who is even older than she is, and who knows who else. We should go to them, not to Maharet.
And you knew I had a son, and you never told me, I said suddenly, impulsively. And you knew what had happened to my rose.
Stop, Lestat, please, said Severin. You're hurting my ears. Your mother only found these things out from me, and went to fetch you immediately and bring you here as I asked. You have been living in your own well-fortified and solitary world. You gave no hint that any of this concerned you. Now come with us to join the others as we ask.
I want to find David and Jesse, I said.
David and Jesse have joined the others, said Krempt.
And what do you know of Maharet right now?
I demanded. I hit the table with my fist.
I'm not omniscient, said Krempt quietly. I could leave this body and I could travel there, invisible, silent, easily enough. But I've forsworn that power. I've trained myself to walk and talk and see and hear as a human being. And besides, whatever is happening with Maharet, none of us can change. I pushed back the chair and rose to my feet.
I have to be alone now, I said. This is all simply too much. I have to wander out there, be alone. I don't know what I'll do. We have several hours more to talk about it. I want to be alone. You should go on to New York, that's certain. All of you should go, and you should fight this voice with all your power. As for me, I don't know.
Severin rose and came around the table and took me by the arm.
All right, then, she said. You go wandering if you must. But I have something that might help you with your meditations, something I arranged especially for you.
She led me out of the room and down a long passage that was covered in soft, glittering gold, like so much of what I'd already seen. But soon another cruder and unadorned passage led us away from this one, and down a long, steep, rock-cut stairs. It seemed we were in a labyrinth, and I caught the scent of human beings. We came finally to a long ramp that led into a small room illuminated only by a couple of thick candles on ledges, and there beyond a wall of iron bars stood a golden-skinned human being staring at me out of the shadows with bitter, furious black eyes. The scent was overpowering, delicious, almost irresistible. The man began to shake the bars with all his strength and rail at Severin in the most vulgar and coarse French I'd ever heard. He hurled one threat after another at her of confederates who'd come to rip her limb from limb and visit every erotic abomination on her that he could conceive. He swore his brothers would never let anyone live who had done harm to him, that she didn't know what she had done to herself, and so forth and so on, round now in circles, damning her under the worst words ever created in any language to denounce a female being. I was fascinated. It had been a long time since I'd encountered anyone so totally given over to evil, and so blatant in his fury. The smell of the sea came off his filthy dungarees and his sweat-soaked denim shirt, and I saw scars cut into his face and into his right arm that had hardened into seams of pure white flesh. Behind me, a heavy door was closed. The creature and I were alone. I saw the key to his cell on a hook to the right of the gate that held him back, and I took it down while he went on raving and cursing, and I turned it slowly in the lock. He flung the gate back immediately and lunged at me, his hands moving to my throat. I let him do this. I let him hurl his full force at a body that did not yield even by a quarter of an inch. And there he was, trying to press his fingers into my neck, and
utterly impotent to make the slightest indentation in my skin and staring into my eyes. He backed up, calculating, and took another tack. Did I want money? He had plenty of money. All right, he was dealing here with something he hadn't encountered before. Yes, we weren't human. He saw that. But he wasn't stupid. He wasn't a fool. What did we want?
Tell me!
He roared at me in French. His eyes moved feverishly over the ceiling, the floor, the walls, the doors.
I want you, I said in French.
I opened my mouth and ran my tongue under my fangs. He didn't believe what he saw. Of course he didn't believe. That was preposterous that such creatures as that were real.
Stop trying to frighten me, he roared again.
He fell into a crouch, shoulders hunched, arms at the ready, fingers balled into fists.
You're enough to take my mind off anything, I said.
I moved closer, sliding my arms around him, sliding them right against that delicious, salty sweat, and drove my teeth swiftly into his neck. That's the least painful way to do it. Go right for the artery, and just let that first pull on his heart quiet his fear. His soul broke open like a rotten carcass, and all of the filth of his life spent in smuggling and thievery and random murder, always murder, murder after murder, poured out like black, viscid crude oil in his blood. We were on the floor of the cell. He was still alive. I was drinking the last dregs, slowly letting the blood drain from his brain and his internal organs, and pulling it towards me with a steady, slow cooperation of his powerful heart. He was a little boy now. A trusting little boy filled with curiosity and dreams, and roaming some countryside very like my own fields and slopes in the Auvergne. And there was so much he wanted to know, so much he wanted to fathom, so many things that he would do. He would grow up and discover the answers. He would know. The snow fell suddenly on the place where he was playing, running, jumping, and spinning in circles with his arms out, and he threw his little head back to swallow the falling snow. The heart stopped. I lay there for a long moment, still feeling the warmth of his chest against me, the side of his face under me, feeling some last quiver of life pass through his arms. Then the voice spoke. The voice was there, low, confidential, right there. And the voice said, "You see, I want to know all those things too. You see, I wanted to know with my whole heart what is snow, and what is beautiful, and what is love. I still want to know. I want to see with your eyes, Lestat, and hear with your ears, and speak with your voice. But you have denied me. You have left me in blindness and misery, and you will pay for that." I climbed to my feet. "Where are you, voice?" I asked. "What have you done to Macare?" He wept bitterly. "How can you ask me such a question? You, of all the blood drinkers spawned by me and sustained by me, you know how helpless I am inside of her. And for me you have no pity, and only hate." He was gone. I tried to anatomize how I knew, what it was I felt when he left me, what were the tiny indications of his sudden abandonment, but I couldn't really even remember all the tiny little aspects of it. I just knew he was gone. "I don't despise you, voice," I said aloud. My voice sounded unnatural in the empty stone chamber. "I have never really despised you. I was guilty of only one thing, not knowing who you really are. You might have told me, voice. You might have trusted me." But he was gone. Gone to some other part of the great savage garden to do mischief, no doubt. I left the dead man, since there seemed no proper place to dump his bloodless carcass, and I started back through the maze to find the others. Somewhere along the way, when stone passages had once more given way to brightly painted passages and golden passages, I heard singing. It was the softest, most ethereal singing, words spun out by high, clear soprano voices in Latin, one thread of melody interweaving with another, and under this the sounds of what had to be a lyre.
The sounds of running water came to me with the exquisite music, singing, running water, splashing water, and the laughter of blood drinkers. Sevrain laughing, my mother laughing. I smelled the water. I smelled sunlight, green grass in the water. Somehow the freshness and sweetness of the water mingled in my mind with the richly satisfying blood that had just flooded my mouth and my brain, and I could all but see the music in golden ribbons winding through the air. I came to a large, cavernous, and brightly lighted bath. Glittering mosaics covered the uneven ceiling and walls. Tiny bits of gold and silver and crimson marble, malachite and lapis lazuli, and shining obsidian and flakes of glinting glass. Candles burned on their bronze stands. Two gentle, dancing waterfalls fed the large rock-cut basin in which they bathed. They were all standing in the water, the women, together under the soft, sparkling downpour, some naked, some clothed in sheer gowns that had turned transparent with the water, faces glistening, hair slicked into long serpentine streaks of darkness over their shoulders, and in the far left corner were the singers, three white-robed blood-drinkers obviously made in boyhood, singing in high, sweet soprano voices, castrati made by the blood. I found myself transfixed by the vision of this. The women beckoned me to come into the bath. The musicians sang on as if blind to all those present, though they were not, each strumming the strings of a small ancient Greek-style lyre. The room was warm and moist, and the light itself was golden from the candles. I moved forward, stripping off my clothes and joining them in the fresh, sweet-smelling pool. They poured the water over me from pink-throated seashells, and I splashed it again and again against my face. Alessandra, naked, danced with her arms up, singing with the boy sopranos, though in words of old French, some poetry of her own, and Sevrain, her body frighteningly pale and hard, the water glancing off it as if it were marble, kissed me on the lips. The sharp, yet exquisitely controlled singing pierced me, paralyzed me as I stood in the cool flowing water. I closed my eyes and thought, always remember this. Always remember, though agony and fear crouch at the door. This, the throb of the lyre strings, and these voices weaving like vines together, climbing to heights undreamt of by the logical, fearful mind, and descending slowly to blend in harmony again. Through the flashing waterfall I looked at them, these boys with their round faces and their short, curling blonde hair. Very slightly they swayed with the music, and it was the music that they saw, not us, not this place, not this now. What does it mean to be a singer in the blood, a musician, to have that purpose, that love affair to carry you through the ages, and to be as happy as all of these creatures seemed to be? Later on, dressed in fresh garments provided by the mistress of the palace, I passed a long shadowy chamber in which Gremt sat with Raymond Galant. There was a blood-drinker with them, as ancient perhaps as was Sevrain, and other ghosts there as beautifully realized in material bodies as were Gremt and Raymond Galant. I was immediately fascinated, but I was also very tired, almost deliciously tired. One of these ghosts rose to greet me and beckoned for me to wait as I stood in the door. I backed up into the passage as this phantom moved out of the room and towards me, not out of fear so much as overwhelming reluctance. I knew where I stood with any human on the planet. I knew what I faced with any blood drinker. But I did not begin to know what I faced with a self-possessed ghost in a solid body. He stood before me, smiling, the light from the shadowy conference room illuminating his rather remarkable face. Smooth forehead, Grecian features, and long, ashen-blonde hair. He was dressed in a long, simple black silk soutane, and it was a real garment, made of raw silk. The skin was not real, no, and the organs within were simulated well, but not real. And who knew what soul lay behind these cheerful, friendly eyes? Once again, I felt keenly that these spirits or ghosts, clothed in bodies of their own making, were exactly like us. They were incarnated souls as we were incarnated souls.
"I've waited a long time to beg your forgiveness for what I did to you," he said in French. "I have hoped and prayed always that you were glad of it, finally. Glad to be living and breathing now, hard as it's been for you on the devil's road." I said nothing. I was trying to figure what this could possibly mean. That a ghost could speak so distinctly in a deep, human voice amazed me. It truly seemed to be coming from his vocal cords. The illusion was perfect. He stood eye to eye with me. He smiled. He reached for my hands and took them in his. "If only there were time for a long meeting," he said. "A time for me to answer your inevitable questions. Time for me to let your anger rise." Soft, dusty fingers. They gave off warmth like human fingers. "What anger?" I asked. "I'm Magnus, the one who made you and abandoned you, and I will always bear the guilt for that." I heard, but I didn't believe. I didn't believe in the possibility of it. My human soul refused. And yet I knew this creature wasn't lying to me. This wasn't the season for lies. This was the season for revelations. And this creature, or being, or entity, or whatever it was, this thing, was telling me the truth. I don't know how many minutes passed as we stood there. "Don't judge me by what you see here," he said. "For a ghost can perfect a body himself which nature never gave him. And that's what I've done. The ghosts of this world have learned much over the centuries, especially the last few hundred years. My body resembles yours now, fine and strong and well-proportioned, a body for which you died, and I have given myself your eyes, your shining blue eyes. But I do beg your forgiveness for bringing you into this realm we now share." A cool draft moved through the passage. I felt a tingling on the surface of my skin. I was trembling. I heard my heart in my ears. "Well, as you said, if only there were time," I responded. "But there isn't time now, is there? It's almost dawn." I struggled to form each word. "I can't stay with you now." I was so grateful for this, so grateful that I had to leave him and move sluggishly, almost drunkenly away. Shock and shock and greater shock. I glanced back at him. How sad he looked, standing there. How forlorn and burdened with grief and sorrow. "You burn bright, Prince Lestat," he said, and tears rose to his eyes. I hurried away. I had to. I had to find some graceful and secret place to lie down in solitude. There was no traveling for me tonight. It was too late. There was only the hope of sleep now. And up ahead, Severin was waiting for me and gesturing for me to hurry. "Give me this little rock-cut tomb of sorts, this shelf on which to lie. Give me these satin pillows, so cool, and these soft woolen covers. Give me this and let me weep alone here. And let me forget all but darkness as you shut the door. And to think, on rising we would go into the kingdom of greater shocks. And all I'd been before this night was gone. Absolutely gone. The world I'd only inhabited a short time ago seemed bleak and empty and over now. All my struggles, my triumphs, my losses, were being eclipsed by what was being revealed now. Had ever ennui and despair been banished by such revelations, such precious gifts of truth?
19. Rochamandes. Murder most foul. For 2 nights, Roche had been holed up in a luxury hotel in Manaus, waking up to look out on the small Amazonian city and the jungles beyond, stretching into infinity. He was furious. He had sent for Benedict, and Benedict had come, as always frayed and exhausted from the lonely journey through miles of uncharted sky, and was now equally agitated by sleeping in this multi-storied mortal hostel with only a hiding place in a closet to keep him safe from the sun and from prying mortal eyes. There was good hunting for a blood drinker in this city, and in its surrounding areas, but that was about all that could be said for it, in Roche's estimation, and he was desperate to penetrate the compound of Maharet, Cayman, and Makari, but he could not. Each night the voice urged him to be strong, to attack the defences of the twins, to force his way in, but Roche was wary. He could not overcome the combined strength of Cayman and Maharet. He knew this, and he did not trust the voice when it said they would never attack him, that he would take them by surprise and find them surprisingly vulnerable to his gifts and his will.
"I need you to free me from this creature," the voice continued to insist. "I need you to free me from this unholy trinity which keeps me captive here, blind and immobile, and unable to fulfill my destiny. And I do indeed have a destiny, and have always had a destiny. Do you know what I have endured to learn how to express myself as I am talking to you now? You are my hope, Roshamandis. You have 5,000 years in the blood, do you not? You are stronger than they are because you know how to use your gifts, and they are reluctant."
Roche had given up arguing honestly with the voice. The voice was a conniver and a child. Roche feared Maharet. He always had. Who in the blood was more powerful than Maharet? She had 1,000 years on him, but she had something else. She'd been one of the first ever made, and her spiritual resources were a legend. If the earliest children of first brood and queen's blood hadn't been deaf to each other telepathically, this drama would have come to a close well before now. If Maharet could hear the voice speaking to Roshalandis, it would be finished for Roche, he was sure. Even now he wondered if this miserable, humid and tropical place was not to be the end of his long journey on this earth. But just when his thoughts sank into discouragement, the voice would come, whispering, cajoling, wheedling.
"I will make you the monarch of the tribe. Don't you see what I'm offering you? Don't you grasp why I need you? Once inside your body, I can walk into the sun of my own free will, because your body is strong enough for this, and all over the world young ones will burn. But you and I inside of you will only be kissed by that golden light. Oh, I remember now. Yes, I remember the blessed peace and strength that came to me when Akasha and Enkil were put into the sun. Golden brown they became, and no more than that, but all over the world children burned. My strong blood was restored to me. I was myself in flashes of waking wonder. We will do that, don't you see, when I am in you and you can brave the sunlight. And you love me. Who else loves me?"
"I love you all right," said Roche grimly. "But not enough to be destroyed trying to take you into me. And if I did have you inside me, would you feel what I feel?"
"Yes, don't you see? I am entombed in one who feels nothing and desires nothing, and never drinks, of the life-giving human blood."
"When I expose myself to the sun, I know pain as I'm falling into unconsciousness, and pain for months after I wake. I do it only because I must, to pass for human. Are you willing to know that pain?"
"That is nothing to the pain I know now," he said. "You'll wake to golden skin, as you know, and so many others will have died, mercifully died, and we will be stronger than ever, don't you see? Yes, I will feel what you feel. Once you have the sacred core in you, you will feel what I feel, too."
The voice rambled on.
"Did I ever promise the Queen of Egypt that I could support a legion of blood-drinkers? Was she mad? Were the first brood not mad? They knew what I was and who I was, and yet they stretched my body and my power beyond all reasonable limits, greedy and wanton, passing the blood to anyone who would revolt against Akasha. And she made this queen's blood as if the size of her god was all that mattered, until I was as a human bleeding from all limbs and all orifices, unable to think, to dream, to know."
Roche was listening, but not much. You will feel what I feel too. The possibilities were blazing in his mind as he stood at the window, looking out over the night-time city of Manaus. What else would you want of me, other than that I sleep under the sun to burn off the riff-raff? The riff-raff? More than the riff-raff would burn. All the many younger ones would burn. Lestat, his precious Louis, Armand, that vicious and notorious tyrant, and, of course, the little genius, Benjamin Mahmoud. And all of their generations would burn. Vampires would burn who had 1,000 years in the blood, or even 2,000. It had happened before, and Rochamandes knew this. It wasn't legend. He had been burned a shining mahogany brown, and suffered agony for months after the king and queen had been dragged into the Egyptian desert by the wicked elder. Had the elder had the strength to leave the divine parents in the sun for 3 days, Rochamandes might have died, and the elder would have died. And who would have come to the rescue of Akasha or Inkel? It would have been the finish, there and then. Somewhere in the world, Severin and Nebamun and countless others must have suffered a similar fate. For those who survived and grew stronger, many perished, driven to further immolation by the pain of their existence. He remembered all that. Yes, he remembered. But no one knew how many years in the blood were needed to survive such a holocaust. Oh, well, maybe the great doctors Farid and Seth knew. Maybe they had made studies, calculations based on interviews with blood drinkers, analysis of accounts in the Vampire Chronicles. Maybe they had made projections. Maybe they could transfuse blood from the ancients to the young ones with glistening plastic sacks and shining plastic tubes. Maybe they had a store of ancient blood in their vaults, drawn out of the veins of the great Seth.
"Oh, yes, they are very clever," said the voice,
ignoring Roche's earlier question and addressing his rambling thoughts.
"But they have no love for me. They are treacherous. They speak of the tribe, as does Benji Mahmoud, as if I were not the tribe," he roared in anguish. "As if I, Ahmed, were not the tribe."
"So you don't want to fall into their hands," said Roche.
"No, never, never!" The voice sounded frantic. "Think what they might do to me. Can you imagine?"
"And what could they possibly do?" asked Roche.
"Put me in a tank of the blood, my blood, blood I made. Put me in a tank of it where I would be blind and deaf and mute and trapped in even deeper darkness than I am in now."
"Nonsense. Somebody would have to feed and sustain such a tank. They'd never do such a dangerous thing. And you are not a separate element now, even I know that. You are wed to the brain of Makari, wed to her heart to pump blood to her brain. If they were to simulate such an arrangement, as I said, someone, and indeed more than one, would have to maintain it and sustain it. That will never happen to you." The voice was clearly mollified. He dropped his voice to a whisper.
"I must be quiet now. But you must come to me. She comes. She's hunted and she is full of despair. She dreams of plunging herself and Makari and me into a lake of fire. She mourns her lost fledglings. She has driven away those who love her."
Rochamandes shook his head. Under his breath he murmured a desperate negation.
"Listen to me," pleaded the voice. "She needs but one word of encouragement from some despairing soul like herself, I tell you, and she will take Makari in her arms and go at once to this volcano called Pacaya. Do you know where that is?"
"Pacaya," whispered Roche. "Yes, I know where it is."
"Well, it is where our story will end in fire if you do not come. It could happen this very night, I tell you."
"You can't read her mind, can you? You're entombed in her maker.
You can't—" "I do not read her mind from Makari's mind, you fool," said the voice. "I go stealthily into her mind as I go into yours. She cannot lock me out. But, oh, if I were to seek to speak to her, how I would terrify her, how I would drive her over the edge."
"Pacaya, an active volcano in Guatemala. Roche was gasping for breath. He was trembling.
"You must come now," said the voice. "Cayman is lost somewhere in the north where I sent him to destroy. He is a ruin of himself, I tell you. He was never crafted for eternity as you were. The mere sight of him goads her to despair. He is a broken instrument. Come to me now. Do you know what a machete is? There are machetes all over this place. Machetes. You know how to use a machete. Free me from this body. And if you do not, I will sing my songs to someone else."
It was gone. He could feel that it was gone. Where had it gone? Off to turn some desperate, fearful blood-drinker somewhere against another? Or to tempt Nebamun, wherever he might be, or even Severin? And what precisely would happen if the sacred core was transferred to such a being? What if the very worst happened, and somehow that impulsive Lestat de Liancourt got control of it in his young body? Perish the thought. And Pacaya? What if she took her twin with her, rose into the air, and sought out that inferno? Oh, what agony would descend on each and every member of the tribe throughout the world as unquenchable heat and flame sought to burn the host of the sacred core. Benedict had fallen asleep on the bed, barefoot in freshly laundered jeans and a white dress shirt open at collar and cuffs. He lay there dreaming. There was something about the sight of him sleeping so trustingly that touched Rochamandis. Of all the blood drinkers Roche had ever made or known, this one's body and face were a true reflection of his soul, no matter how much time passed. This one knew how to love. No wonder it had been Benedict who brought the memoirs of the Vampire Chronicles to Roche, and insisted he read them. No wonder Benedict had so cherished Louis de Pointe-du-Lac's suffering and Lestat's wild rebellion.
"They understand," he'd told Roche. "We cannot live without love. Doesn't matter how old, how strong we are, what we possess. We cannot exist without love. It's absolutely impossible. And they know it, young as they are. They know."
Roche sat down gently beside him and touched his back. The cotton shirt was soft, clean against his smooth skin. His neck and his soft, curly brown hair was silky. Roche bent to kiss his cheek.
"Wake up now, Ganymede," he said. "Your maker needs you."
He ran his hand over the boy's hips and his slender, powerful thighs, feeling the iron muscles under the starched denim. Had there ever been a more nearly perfect body in the blood? Well, perhaps in Alessandra, before she'd become a crone of her own making, twisted, leering, mad, a ragged monster of the children of Satan. But this was surely the next best body, wasn't it? Benedict woke with a start, staring blindly forward.
"The voice," he murmured against the pillow. "The voice is saying, come, isn't it?"
"And we will. But you are to stay some 20 feet behind me. You come when I call to you."
20 feet against monsters like this.
Roche stood and pulled Benedict to his feet.
"Well, 50 feet, then. Stay out of sight, but near enough to hear my slightest command, and come instantly."
How many times had Roche instructed Benedict in how to use the fire gift, how to muster it and send it against any blood drinker who ever tried to use it against him, how to fight off the power of another older killer, how to slam back with full force against gifts that seemed on the surface to be overwhelming? How many times had he demonstrated how he might do things with his mind which he'd thought impossible, opening doors, shattering them, blowing them off their hinges?
"No one knows the full measure of anyone else's powers," he'd said countless times over the centuries. "You survive the attacks of others when you fight. Fight and flee, do you hear me?"
But Benedict was no natural warrior. In that short span of his mortal life on earth, he'd been a prayerful scholar, only tempted by the sensuality of the natural world all around him to abandon his Christian God. He'd been a being made for monastery libraries and royal courts, a lover of gorgeously illustrated manuscripts and books, of flutes and drums and lutes playing, of blended voices in song, of the love of men and women in silken beds and in perfumed gardens. Not a warrior. No, never. He'd only sinned against his Christian God because he couldn't see the harm in loving passion. And the satisfaction of his rampant desires had always been easy, harmonious, pleasant. A deep chill passed through Roche. Perhaps he had done the very wrong thing, bringing Benedict here. But was he not infinitely more vulnerable miles away, even in the crypt, to some trickery on the part of the voice? Well, there was no time to go over a plan now, not when Maharit was returning to her fortress, and when she might, with those preternatural ears, hear what she could not hear telepathically.
Put on your shoes. We're going now.
Finally they stood like dark shadows in the open window. Not a single mortal eye saw them ascend. And only moments passed before they came down silently into the jungles surrounding Maharit's compound.
"Ah, you are here, and not a moment too soon," said the voice, fearlessly, inside Roche's head. "And she is here. She comes, and she leaves the gates open behind her. Hurry before she presses all her magical electric buttons and closes me off in this prison."
He stepped inside the great wire mesh enclosure, and walked quietly towards the lighted archway.
"The machetes! Do you see them?" said the voice. "They are against the wall. They are sharp."
Roche was tempted to say, "If you don't shut up, you're going to drive me mad." But he didn't. He clenched his teeth, lifted his chin slightly. And yes, he did see the long wooden-handled machete lying on the wooden bench among the pots of orchids. He did see the blade glinting in the light from the arch, though it was caked with mud.
"She dreams of Pacaya," said the voice. "She sees its boiling crater. She sees white steam rising to the dark sky. She sees lava flowing down the mountain in fiery fingers of light. She thinks nothing can live in that inferno, not her, not her sister."
Oh, if he could only shut out the voice.
"And I dare not seek to deter her, for I am what she fears above all things."
There was a dark shape to his left. He saw it just as he picked up the machete and watched the caked mud fall off the blade. Slowly he raised his eyes to see the figure of one of the twins staring at him. One, but which one? He was petrified, holding the machete in his hand. Those blue eyes were fixed on him in a kind of dreamy indifference, the light from the doorway slicing out the edge of the smooth, expressionless face. The eyes moved on away from him indifferently.
"That is Megare," the voice whispered. "That is my prison. Move on. Move on as if you know where you are going. Do you know where you are going?"
A soft, broken-hearted crying reached his ears. It was coming from the lighted room beyond the archway. He made his way forward on the soft earthen path, clutching the machete in his right hand, fingers massaging the rough wooden handle. Strong, heavy handle, monstrous blade, 2 feet in length, perhaps, a powerful cleaver. He could smell the steel blade, smell the dried mud, and smell the moist earth all around him. He reached the doorway. Maharit sat in a dark brown rattan chair with her face in her hands, her body clothed in a long robe of dark rose cotton. Long sleeves covered her arms, and her fingers as white as her face were dripping with the delicate blood of her tears, her long copper hair tossed behind her, covering her bent back. She was barefoot. She cried softly.
"Cayman,"
she said softly in an agonized voice. And slowly she sat back, turning to face him wearily. With a start she saw him there in the doorway. She didn't know who he was. She couldn't pick his name suddenly from all the years, all the many years.
"Kill her," said the voice. "Get rid of her now."
"Benedict," he said loudly, distinctly, most certainly loud enough for his companion to hear, and at once he heard the boy coming through the garden.
"What is it you want of me?"
asked the woman facing him. The blood made 2 fine strokes down her cheeks like the painted tears of a French clown with a china face. Her eyes were rimmed in red, her eyebrows gleaming golden.
"Ah, so it's brought you here, has it?"
she said. She rose to her feet in one swift movement, the chair thrown back and over behind her. Some 5 feet stood between them. Behind him, Benedict stood waiting. He could hear Benedict's breath.
"Don't speak to her!" cried the voice inside his head. "Don't believe what she says to you!"
"What right have you to be here?"
she demanded. It was the ancient tongue now. He kept his face a mask. He gave not the slightest indication that he understood her. Her face changed, her features knotting, her mouth twisting, and he felt the blast hit him full force. Back he hurled it against her. She staggered and fell over the chair. Again she hit him with it full force to drive him back and away. "Benedict!" he cried. And this time he sent the fire gift at her with all his power, lunging for her as he did so, the machete raised. She screamed. She screamed like a helpless village woman in a war, a powerless and frantic being, but as she reached for her chest with both hands, she sent the fire gift against him, and he felt the intolerable heat just as she was feeling it, felt his body burning in unspeakable pain. He denied the pain. He refused to be defeated, refused to freeze in panic. He heard Benedict shouting as he sought to drive her back, Benedict's left hand on his back. It was an ugly battle cry, and he heard the same coming from his own lips. Again he mastered his power and aimed it at her heart, as he brought down the machete with all his physical strength, sinking the blade deep into her neck. A dreadful roar rose from her. Blood shot up out of her mouth in a horrid fountain.
"Cayman!"
she roared, the blood bubbling from her lips.
"Mikari!"
Suddenly a whole litany of names broke from her, names of all she'd known and loved, and a great choking wail.
"I am dying! I am murdered!"
Her head was falling back, her neck twisting desperately, her hands reaching up to steady her own head, the blood splashing all over her cotton robe, all over her hands, splashing on him. He grabbed the machete with both hands, and slammed it into her neck again with all his force, and this time the head came off, and flew through the air and landed on the moist earthen floor of the room. Her headless body sank down to the ground, its hands reaching up desperately. And as it fell forward on its breasts, the hands clawed at the earth, clawed like talons. The head lay there staring to one side, the blood flowing slowly out of it. Who knew what prayers, what pleas, what desperate entreaties still came from her?
"Look at it! The body!"
Benedict wailed. He beat on Rush's back with his fists.
"She's crawling to it!"
Rush charged forward, his boot crunching into the headless torso, crushing it down into the mud, and switching the machete to his left hand, he grabbed up the bleeding head by the copper hair. Her eyes shifted and fixed him firmly as the mouth gaped, and a low whisper came from the quivering lips. He dropped the machete, and backing up, shoving Benedict out of his path, nearly stumbling over the flailing body, he swung the head against the wall again and again, but he could not break the skull. Suddenly he dropped the thing, dropped it into the dirt, and he was down on his hands and knees, and Benedict's boot came down right in front of him, and he saw the machete come flashing down and slice into the shining copper hair, slice through it, slice into the skull, and the blood bubbled up, crimson and glittering. The head was on fire. Benedict was blasting it. The head was in flames. He knelt there a mute witness, helpless, utterly helpless, watching the head blacken and burn, watching the hair go up in sizzling smoke and sparks. Yes, the fire gift. Finally he rallied. He sent it with full fury, and the head was curling up, black, like that of a plastic doll on a burning trash heap, and the eyes gleamed white for 1 second before they turned black, and the head was as a lump of coal with no face, no lips, dead and ruined. He scrambled to his feet. The headless body lay still. But Benedict was now blasting this, too, blasting the blood that was flowing out of it, and the whole prone figure there went up in flames, the cotton robe consumed. In a panic, Roche turned right and left. He stumbled backwards. Where was the other one? Nothing stirred. No sound came from the garden enclosure. The fire crackled and snapped and smoked. And Benedict was catching his breath in anxious, musical sobs. His hand was on Roche's shoulder. Roche stared at the darkened mass that had been her head. The head of the witch who had come to Egypt long ago with the spirit Amel, who had gone into the mother, the head of the witch who had endured for 6,000 years without ever going down into the earth to sleep, this great witch and blood-drinker who had never made war on anyone except the queen who'd torn her eyes from her and condemned her to die. She was gone now. And he, Rosh, had done this. He and Benedict at his instigation. He felt a sorrow so immense, he thought he would die from the weight of it. He felt it like his very breath gathering in his chest, in his throat, threatening to suffocate him. He ran his fingers back through his hair, tearing at his hair, pulling it suddenly in two hanks, pulling it till it hurt, and the pain sliced into his brain. He staggered into the doorway. There, only 10 feet away, stood the other, unchanged, a lone, robed figure in the night, looking around her with a drifting gaze, a glinting, drifting gaze at leaves, at trees, at creatures moving in the high branches, at the moon far above the compound.
"Now you must do it!" roared the voice. "Do to her what you have done to her sister, and take the brain from her and into yourself. Do it!"
The voice was screaming. Benedict stood beside him, clinging to him. Rosh saw the bloody machete in Benedict's right hand, but he didn't reach for it. The sorrow was knotted inside him, twisted, like a rope pulled tight around his heart. He couldn't speak, couldn't think.
"I have done wrong. I have done unspeakable wrong."
"I'm telling you, do it now,"
said the voice, in a tone of perfect desperation.
"Take me into your body. You know how to do this. You know how it was done to Akasha. Do it now. Do it as you did to that one. Do it. I must be freed from this prison. Are you mad? Do it."
"No," said Rosh.
"You betray me now? You dare? Do as I tell you."
"I can't do it alone," Rosh said. For the first time he realized he was trembling violently all over, and a blood sweat had broken out on his face and on his hands. He could feel his heart knocking in his throat. The voice had given way to cursing, babbling, screaming. The mute woman stood there unchanged. Then the distant cry of a bird seemed to waken her, and she bowed her head just a little to the left, towards Rosh, as though she were looking upwards for that bird outside the wire mesh of the garden. Slowly she turned and walked slowly away from Rosh, through the gentle crowd of fern and palm, her feet making a soft, unhurried trudging sound in the soil. A kind of humming came from her. On she moved, away from him. The voice was crying. The voice was weeping. "I tell you, I cannot do it without help," Rosh said. "I need help. The help of that vampire doctor, if I'm to do it, don't you see? What if I start to die when she does? What if I can't do what Makari did when she killed Akasha? I can't do it." The voice whimpered and sobbed. It sobbed like a broken and defeated thing.
"You are a coward,"
the voice whispered.
"You are a miserable coward."
Rosh made his way to a chair. He sat down, leaning forward, his bloody arms clutching his chest. "And I have done unspeakable evil. How can I live now after what I've done?"
"What do we do?"
asked Benedict frantically. Rosh scarcely heard him.
"Evil, without question. Evil by all I've ever held to be right, or just, or good."
"Rosh!"
Benedict pleaded. Rosh looked up at him, struggling to focus, to think.
"I don't know," Rosh said. "Cayman is coming," said the voice miserably. "Will you let him murder you without a fight?"
It was an hour before Cayman appeared. They had buried Maharet's remains. They lay in wait, the two on either side of the door, both armed now with the machetes from the garden. Cayman returned weary and listless, wind-blown and sad, and came into the room like a labourer, so tired from his work that he couldn't even seek a chair to rest. For a long moment he stood there, breathing slowly and evenly with his hands at his sides. Then he saw the dark, greasy bloodstains all over the mud floor. He saw the soot, the ashes. He saw the earth churned up where she had been hastily buried. He looked up, and then he spun around, but he had no chance. With the two machetes they hacked at his powerful neck from both sides, almost instantly decapitating him. No words came from him, and when his head fell, his black eyes were wide with astonishment. Roche picked up the head and drank from the neck. He held it with both hands as he drank, and though his vision misted, and his heart beat in his eyes and in his ears, he could see the headless body dying as he pulled the blood from the brain. This powerful, thick blood, this viscid, delicious, ancient blood. Never could he have drunk a drop from Maharet. Never. The mere thought of it revolted him. And indeed he did not think of it. But now he thought only, this is a warrior as I was a warrior. This is the leader of the first brood who fought Queen's blood, and he is in my hands now. Caiman, the defeated leader. And Roche drank and drank the blood, and the images poured forth into him. The portal between first brood and Queen's blood opened. Images of this being when he had been young, vital and human. No. Roche dropped the head. He didn't want those images. He didn't want to know Caiman. He didn't want those images inside his brain. He burnt the body and the head. There was a fountain in the garden outside, a Grecian fountain. When it was all finished and the body was buried, he went there and washed his hands and his face, and rinsed out his mouth and spit the water down on the earth. Benedict did the same.
"And what will you do now?" asked the voice. "This thing in which I am entombed will seek shelter from the sun soon, for that is absolutely all that she knows, the sum total of all her discernment and all her millennia."
The voice laughed. He laughed and laughed like a mortal on the verge of madness. He laughed a high-pitched and genuine laugh, as if he simply couldn't help himself. The jungle around them was waking. The morning air had come. That air that all blood-drinkers know when the hour of dawn is approaching, when the morning birds sing, when the sun is nearing the horizon. Makari moved slowly as a great rapid across the garden and into the room, and across the mud floor and through a doorway to an inner chamber. Roche would not remain in this place, no. He wanted to be gone now. He felt sick remaining in this room.
"And so we shall seek shelter at the hotel tonight," said Roche. "And then we will think what to do, how to get that Farid to assist us." "Well, I can give you a little assistance, my timid charge," said the voice bitterly.
He had finally exhausted himself with his laughing. He had an anguished tone Roche had never heard before.
"I will tell you precisely how to enlist the cooperation of Farid. I would have told you long before now if I'd known you were such a miserable coward, such a bumbler. Remember these names. Rose and Victor. For Rose alone Farid may not do your bidding. For Victor, he will do anything, and so will the elite of the tribe, the entire blessed elite of the tribe, now gathering under the roof of this house in New York, called Trinity Gate."
He began to laugh again, wildly, uncontrollably, a laugh more filled with pain than any Rose had ever imagined.
"And Lestat will do your bidding too, I'm certain of it. Oh, yes. You coward! You can make them cooperate. For the love of Victor..."
He went on laughing.
"This Victor is Lestat's son, the son of his body and blood, the son of his genes, his human offspring. You get hold of this son and you will be the victor, and so shall I. Get that boy in your hands, in your power, do you hear me? And we will triumph together. And once I am inside you, they will not dare to anger you. You and I shall rule them together."
Part 3. Ragnarok in the Capital of the World. 20. Rose, in the topless towers of Midtown. He was irresistible. Rose had been listening to him for hours. She could have listened forever to his faintly sonorous voice. Victor, too, had been listening, standing quietly by the open kitchen door. Victor, in his jeans and white polo shirt, with that loving smile playing on his lips, distracted her by his sheer presence. She wanted to be in his arms again, alone, soon, in the bedroom.